So I'll start the talk this morning with a chant. I've been doing this for the last few weeks, I think. So, and this will introduce the subject for the talk, part of the subject. Asevana chambalanam panditanam cha sevana puja cha pujaniyanam etang mangalamutamam. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So they're the words of the Buddha. And again, I'll ask another test. What do people recognize these words? Yes, it's the only one I quote, isn't it? This, people probably think it's the only one he knows. So what does it mean? That's probably more important. What was the Buddha pointing to? And this is what he was saying. Not to associate with fools, to associate with the wise, to honour those worthy of honour. These are the highest blessings. So this morning I was going to focus on those worthy of honour. The Buddha was advising us we should honour. But first of all, what it's pointing to, and this is the theme of this, will be actually linked to last week's talk. At the end of that, people were asking about parents, and I spoke a bit about parents. I think I answered a question about parents, actually. So this talk is actually about parents and respecting, in this case, respecting parents. I was actually going to include gratitude or thanks to our parents, but I think that's too big a talk. So the first thing, and I think actually very big issues here for us, you know, as Buddhists and as people living in the West, is two issues actually, but they relate in this talk anyway, and that is the issue of respect. What are those things that are worthy of honour? Are the things that we are respecting in the West? Respecting as Buddhists, are they worthy of that respect? So that's one of the aspects of it. And then the other aspect, of course, is our parents. Should we respect our parents? And of course, from the Buddhist perspective, it's always yes. So what is respect? I think this is something that is very important in the West, actually. I think you can give a whole talk on respect, because we live in a culture of disrespect, I think. Actually, that's my take on it anyway. So what is respect? And these are sort of like definitions or ways we can view respect. And it's looking up to someone or something. And it can be admiration for a quality of that person or their achievements. So, for instance, the Buddha, when he was talking of those that are worthy of honour, I just mentioned that. The Buddha was talking about respect for the Buddha and enlightened beings and the Dhamma and parents and also elders in the community. So, and when the Buddha became enlightened, actually it's quite interesting, the first thing he thought of, this is amongst the first things, is who could he respect? And this is somebody, you know, who's just attained awakening, full enlightenment, has understood the nature of reality. And he realized there was no individual that he could respect, whether it be a god, a human being, or whatever type of being. But then he realized that he could respect the Dhamma. So if a being like the Buddha thinks, I need something or someone to respect, how much more so us, actually? So also respect has that sense of bowing down too, and you see this very often physically for Buddhists. Some people will see, you know, paying respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and when we bow to the Buddha statue. It's not actually bowing to the statue, it's bowing to what it symbolises. That's a very important distinction. And as I say, the bowing down that we do is through our body, speech and mind. If it is only through body and speech, but not in our minds, that's not really respect, is it? It's just very superficial. And often we have that in Buddhist countries, there is the convention of bowing down. But I don't know, we don't know, if the mind is bowing down too, if it's really got that respect in it. That's something we can't tell. And respect can also be, isn't it, consideration for the feelings of people and the rights of other people. That's a more standard definition that we have in the West. And as I say, we do this through body, speech and mind. And the Buddha said that it creates good karma. In the commentaries, it talks about apachayana karma, that it creates this karma of a positive, wholesome quality in the mind, this reverence. And it creates good karma in the mind, this wholesome quality, this wholesome energy. So, and as I just mentioned, the Buddha recommended that we have respect for, we honour the Buddha, awakened beings, any stage of awakening, stupas, monks and nuns, parents and elders. So, and there probably are others that we could include in that. So, but I'll go into this a little bit more in a while. So one of the questions I would ask, and I'm sort of already flagged it actually, does our society promote respect for parents? Does it promote respect in general actually? Is respect for parents seen as something good? And this is something that I think we have to answer individually, you know. We have to answer, because the Buddha's not here to to make a comment about that. We have to ask ourselves. And as I said, I wonder whether our society, Western societies, promote a culture of disrespect. And actually that's seen as being sort of cool, really. And we often, you know, we have this feeling that people and things have to earn our respects. And that's true enough. Because the Buddha said, you know, those who are worthy of honour, didn't he? He said that. And we also, the difficulty we have is that, you know, with investigative journalism these days, we know the nitty-gritty of everything and everyone practically. You know, the royal family, they can't breathe, can't sneeze without us knowing about it, what colour socks they're wearing, that sort of thing. So also when we have all these disclosures of scandals, etc., it reduces our respect. And that's natural. And it's not that we should not have those disclosures. But I think in the bottom line is to see the qualities that we can still respect without, having a blanket disrespect, which tends to be the default fault mode for us. And as I mentioned, the Buddha. And Aya Kemoj, I liked what she said. You know, when we take refuge, refuge is a little bit higher than respect, isn't it? When you bow to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, you're saying we're taking refuge in the sense we're seeing them, the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, as the highest, as something that we can find protection in, something we can find guidance from. And so this is the highest sort of form of respect. And as Aya Kemoj pointed out, when you take refuge, you take refuge in that which is enlightened, that which is awakened. So the Buddha, you take refuge in the Dhamma, this is the highest, and the Sangha, that's the highest, awakened monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. So these are the things that she was pointing to, that we take refuge in. But of course, refuge is a stronger form of respect, really. And the important thing, as I mentioned before, is respect is actually a wholesome state of mind. It's not a well-known state of mind, actually, these days, but it is a very wholesome state of mind, and we get the benefit if we have respect in the mind. We get, it's a very pleasant feeling, it's leads to happiness. You notice disrespect, on the other hand, you can see where it's coming from, can't you? Often disrespect comes from fault-finding, and maybe there's a good basis for it. That's for sure. There are many things that are worth, you know, criticising and pointing out the shortcomings of. But if our mind is only in that mode of fault-finding, it's a very unhappy sort of state of mind. It's an unpleasant state of mind. It's an unwholesome state of mind. And I know I meet, as a monk, I meet plenty of people with lots of respect, you know, whether it be in Sri Lanka or here. And I just see, you know, when you see someone with respect, it's this quality, isn't it, the Buddha pointed to, of saddha, or faith, confidence. It's really, people that have it just sparkle, actually. And when they, for instance, when people bow to me here or in Sri Lanka, I don't take it personally at all, because they don't know me. They don't necessarily know me. You know, they may have met me once or twice or whatever, seen me on YouTube, as some people do. But what they're bowing to is what this robe stands for. It stands for the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, the highest possibility. You know, whether I am totally worthy of that that respect is another issue. I don't take it personally. But what I see is somebody with this beautiful energy, this beautiful state of mind. It's like interior decorating. Somebody that has respect has really got a lovely state of mind. And you check it out for yourself. You know, when we have disrespect, there's always suspicion, you know, prove it to me sort of attitude. And this is something I think we look at and just see, you know, is this something worthy of developing? And if we do develop it, what are the consequences? Does it lead to my happiness and well-being, anybody else's happiness and well-being? And so in terms of respect, and I was wondering why there is such a difference. You probably have got your own ideas. Why there's such a difference between the East and the West, between particularly Buddhist countries, but generally the East. Why are, for instance, in the West, parents often viewed in a negative light? And many people will recognize this as being the case, that parents are often blamed for a lot, actually, in the West. And so I reflected on that, and what came to me very strongly is that in the difference between the West and the East, the difference between Buddhist cultures and non-Buddhist cultures, basically, is right view. This is called samadhi. Samadhi. This is the way we view the world. This is what the Buddha said reality. This is how reality is, actually. It's not something we have to believe in, but it's something we investigate and we find out if it's true from our own experience. So the Buddha, he was talking about a right view on two levels. I often call it the mundane. I never like this word mundane. It sort of sounds like something, you know, taking the rubbish out every week or something. But it's a more worldly level. Perhaps that's a better way to put it, worldly level. I feel more comfortable with that one. And he said what constitutes this worldly right view is understanding. It is a belief, in a sense, taking on board, being open to the fact that there is karma, there is working of our wholesome actions of body, speech and mind lead to wholesome results. Our negative actions of body, speech and mind lead to negative results. There is rebirth, so there is another life after this. This is not the end of the story, according to the Buddha. There is dana, so in other words, giving is powerful. Dana is a word for generosity, but it's also giving. And this is powerful, actually. And this is interesting. The Buddha says there are parents. So he puts them in right view. This is extraordinary, actually. You may think, well, so what? But he puts them in right view as well. So and I'll go into that later as well, but obviously from a Buddhist perspective, our relationship to our parents is a very karmic relationship. It's not an accidental relationship. We are attracted to our parents. And the last category of right view are that there are awakened beings in the world. And I'll read what the Buddha actually says, so you get the actual word of the Buddha. And it's pretty clear, actually, I think, though I've explained a little bit there. And the Buddha said, there is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. So there are results of this. There is fruit and result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. This is like heavenly beings, actually. There are in the world good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins. These are like spiritual practitioners who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. So these are enlightened beings. And the other level of right view, of course, the higher level is the Four Noble Truths that most Buddhists know about, that the noble truth of suffering or unsatisfactoriness, the noble truth of the cause of that being our wanting, desiring, and the noble truth of the ending of unsatisfactoriness, which is giving up that wanting, that desire. which keeps us going in samsara. And the fourth noble truth, of course, is the path that leads to the ending of unsatisfactoriness, of suffering. And so these are very, this is a level that this is very common in the, this is what the Buddha is teaching, and this is where right view is so important for the practicing the path of the Buddha. You know, if we don't practice it with this view in mind, if we, you know, if it's a working hypothesis, we don't have to believe it, as I say, but we can test it out, which is the important thing. And as I mentioned, our relationship with our parents is not accidental, it's special. And I would say that we want to be born to our parents. We're attracted to the parents which we're with whom we are born. Sometimes you might question that because you think some parents are wonderful, but some parents are not so wonderful, you know, can be really difficult. And what is the relationship there? I think the mechanism may just be that sense of attraction. And it's only when the baby's born that you realise that the attraction's actually negative, but it's quite a powerful attraction, like a magnet, draws us to rebirth. And what is drawing us to rebirth is wanting, our desire. In the Pali language, we call it tanha, this desire. That drives us to rebirth. So any child that says, and I've heard this, I didn't ask to be born to you, to the parents. And I've heard this. I'm just hoping I never said it, but it's possible I did. I think many parents in the West hear this, don't they? They hear this. This is coming from wrong view. Absolutely, you know. That they had nothing, the child had nothing to do with this. It's just mum and dad's fault. And also you realise that what the other part of right view, apart from, you know, the special relationship of parents, is the fact that there is rebirth. The Buddha is asking us to accept or to use as a working hypothesis that there are other lives. I know there are Buddhists who don't take that hypothesis, and that's okay too, but as long as they investigate, you know, and just ask, is it really true? Have an open mind about it. But I would say, as most parents realise too, we come to this life with habits, characteristics, qualities, abilities, tendencies. And I think most parents here, would you agree that your children, when you have had children, that they have different personalities is probably what we'd say. And many parents would say from very early on, you know, this is even if like just almost newly born, which is amazing. So immediately you could say, well, where do these tendencies, these habits, these abilities come from? And of course, for me, you know, it's very compelling. And I always say to people, if you want to, you know, convince somebody about rebirth, or you want them to think about rebirth, point them to YouTube videos of child geniuses. Point them to YouTube videos of children that remember their past lives. Then they can make up their own mind from watching that. So you see, I've seen these videos where you see children who can play the piano or a musical instrument like a maestro at 2 or 3 years old, something like that. Or you can see, I've seen one with a young boy who was fantastic with mathematics. He could do these sort of incredible equations. I don't remember his age, 3 or 4. And of course, you remember with these children that remember their previous lives, you see them remembering amazing things. And in fact, one of the ones that I've been talking about this week is one that comes from Sri Lanka. And it shows this young girl, she's about 3 or 4, I think, and she's being interviewed and asked Dhamma questions in Sinhala. This is the language of Sri Lanka. And though I'm not, you know, I don't understand all of it, it's very obvious that what she's saying is amazing Dhamma. You know, she's speaking like a monk or a nun would speak. You know, she's giving definitions of sankhara. There's a very deep aspect of Buddhism. And she, evidently, there's quite a few videos of her. And she's not being prompted. She's not finding it hard. It's flowing very naturally. So where does this come from? We should ask. Well, we should investigate. Because Buddhism is quite scientific in many ways. It's asking us to investigate, to look at things, and then we can make up our minds. In the in Western culture and Western philosophy, there's often the idea of one life. This is just, this life is it. So with that, and they have, it comes from the idea too, supported by the idea that a child comes like a blank, we say slate. This is something you like a blackboard, a little blackboard. And they have a Latin name for this, like tabula rasa, I think it's something like that. That it's blank, like the child's come here, is born from wherever, from God, presumably, and then we're writing, the parents are writing on their slate. They're the only influences on the parents' life. Of course, the other aspect in the West, because this is a very problematic way of looking at it, then you have to say, well, you know, what about these things that, you know, people seem to, you know, have innately? So then we have the nature and the nurture controversy. It's probably not a controversy now, actually, a discussion. So nurture is the effect of the parents, but then people realise, hang on, you can't explain everything due to that. So then they say it's DNA, it's genetic, it's this and that. So they're looking for a physical base, a physical explanation for it that shaped the child. But the result of this, and it's pretty logical, isn't it, is that the parents can see themselves as the main influence on the child, for the better or for the worse. So if your children turn out very well, then the parents will feel, great, I've done a good job. If they turn out to be real rat bags, what do the parents feel? They think, wow, it's my fault. They may feel guilty, they may feel blamed. Well, they will. The children might even blame them as well, actually. And certainly psychology and, you know, people like Freud will often leave the blame on the doorstep of parents. And if you have a view of one life only, it's completely logical, isn't it? You know, where else? Who else? You know, you could say DNA, genetics, hereditary, but maybe. And as I mentioned, some children will say, oh, I didn't ask to be born to you. But in Buddhist countries, of course, this is Buddhist countries in Asia in general, because Asian culture, particularly India, has an idea of reincarnation, slightly different from rebirth in Buddhism. So parents know, they don't focus on it, that their child has probably had previous lives before it came to them, and that they are not the sole influence on the child. That this child has brought these talents, abilities, these negative qualities, whatever habits with them from the past as well. Of course, the parent is having an influence. And because of that, this is what I would say, parents are respected, more respected in the East and in Buddhist countries, and more cared for as a result. So for instance, I know even here that, for instance, in Sri Lanka, people do not like to put their parents in a retirement home. They almost feel guilty when they do that. There's good reasons for it sometimes, have to. But it's something that they feel uncomfortable with, because it's a very strong thing to care for your parents, look after them, if you can. It's not always possible. So the next focus that I was going to ask, this is actually the title of the talk, because it'll catch people's attention, so this is for Sriju. Was the Buddha a good parent? Was the Buddha a good parent? Now, this is a big question, actually. I think people will think, wow, yeah. Because as many people, when they hear that, there will be things that occur to you, won't they? That particularly, you know, for people in the West, it's very different from a context of Asia or from Buddhist countries. They will think, the Buddha abandoned his son. He abandoned his family. He went off and did his own thing and left them in the lurch, as it were. Of course, he left them in a palace, so very comfortable and so forth. So it wasn't exactly the lurch, a comfortable lurch, you could say. But of course, in the Eastern context, it's not seen like that at all. You know, in fact, you know, in traditional commentarial literature, it's called the Mahanikamma, the great renunciation when the Buddha left. Why? Because he's leaving the lap of luxury. He's giving up the comforts of the palace. But more also, is giving up that attachment to his wife and his child that's just been born, recently born. So this for Buddhists is really inspiring. In the West, we don't have that context. We think, wow, he's being a really negligent parent, actually going off and doing his own thing. So this, and when the Buddha's son was born, the name he gave him, of course, is Rahula. People know Rahula, and most people know what it means too. It's supposed to mean the fetter. This is something that binds. I would give a better, more modern translation, perhaps, is if you called your child the attachment. Now, that's really, that's in your face, isn't it? Calling your child the attachment. Wow. In Buddhist context, it's just wow. Maybe in terms of an email, it's different. But so it's really a strong name, actually. And one of the things that in the commentaries, for instance, with the Great Renunciation, you have the Bodhisattva. He wasn't the Buddha yet, and he was in leaving home in search of the truth. He was leaving the palace, according to the commentaries, immediately after the birth of his son. In fact, he was supposed to be born that night. He's leaving in the dead of night, so that nobody knows he's going. And, you know, if you see the film Siddhartha at all, it's very poignant, actually, because you see him looking at the child before he goes, and you know what a tug at his heartstrings that must have been, how difficult. And as I say, in the West, we would see this as him abandoning his family, abandoning his responsibilities. However, the Buddha tells us, and this is not the commentaries, this is what the Buddha said about his leaving the palace. And this is in the Noble Search, the Arya Parivesana Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 26. He says, later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth, this is the Buddha, in the Bodhisattva, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So this is pretty clear, isn't it? That it's none of this drama of him leaving in the middle of the night, leaving the family in the lurch. It also makes me wonder too, how would he have named his child if he left immediately the child was born? So I suspect the child was around for some, had been born, and the Bodhisattva was living at home at that time. So that's a very different take on it. It's not as dramatic. If you see the film Siddhartha, and I've seen that one actually, it's very dramatic with the Bodhisattva leaving home. You know, and for Buddhists, this is seen as a really good thing, you know, a wonderful thing. In the West, we don't view it that way. And the difference, of course, is that from a Buddhist perspective, we know he came back to his family. He came back to his hometown. Not only did his father become enlightened, he became an Anagami, I think, as I remember. His wife became an Arahant. His son became an Arahant. Many of his relatives became fully awakened, fully enlightened. So he didn't neglect his responsibilities at all, actually. And one of the reasons that behind, this is going on quite a bit about it, but behind the reason that the Bodhisattva had a son, it's very strange when you contemplate it, because it was very late. He'd been married, I think, at 13 or 16, and here he was 29 having his first child. That's quite a long time, isn't it, for any? That's waiting. That's definitely waiting in the wings. And I reflect, and I think I've heard this from Ajahn Brahm, this is where I first heard it, and I'm sure many historians and thinkers will also think this, that maybe having the child was part of a deal. You have a child and then you can leave the palace. Then you can seek the spiritual life, then you can seek truth, part of a deal. And it makes sense to me. And you often see it in the suttas, actually, with other monks and nuns, that their parents will say that to them. Before you can leave the home life, before you can leave the marriage, give us an heir before you go. And I think also when parents ask that, there's obviously a, what do you call it, agenda. They're hoping that having had the child, whether it be a boy or a girl, then they'll change their minds. I think, oh, well, I can't go now. You know, because of that attachment, it's very strong, you know. As I was saying to a number of people, that the having one's first child, they say, many people will say, it's the greatest happiness in their life. It seems, and this is amazing, because you think it's greater than meeting your partner, greater than, you know, a lot of your business successes or whatever successes you have in life. So this is quite an amazing experience. But in the case of the Bodhisattva, he didn't stay at home. He didn't remain there. He named the child, it sounds like, but was not attached. So I think now a time for something lighter. Actually, it could have come a little bit earlier. And this is, it's a joke, really. A child asked his father, how were people born? How were people born? This is something children do ask, don't they? And so his father said, Adam and Eve made babies, then their babies became adults and made babies and so on. Now, this is a common explanation. Is it a common one these days? Maybe people do. Maybe Buddhists wouldn't perhaps say this. It's a common one in Christian countries. And then the child went to his mother or her mother and asked the same question. And she told him or her, we were monkeys and then we evolved to become like we are now. We were monkeys. I don't know how many parents would tell their children that, would you? I wouldn't. I think, wow, that's pretty amazing. And then the child rang back to his father and said, or her father, and said, you lied to me. And her or his father replied, no, I didn't lie to you. Your mother was talking about her side of the family. I like that. Quick thinking, wasn't it? Quite funny. That's why we human beings are. So I thought just to actually return to the word of the Buddha and to focus on some of the things he said about parents, about their importance and respect for their parents. This is the focus of this talk, is about respect. Maybe I'll do another talk on gratitude. Maybe it's too much to have two talks, but nevertheless. This is what the Buddha said, and then I'll go into it in a little detail. Monks, those families dwell with Brahma, this is like the highest god, where at home the mother and father are respected by their children. So that's number one. Goes on, it's pretty strong. Those families dwell with the first teachers, where at home the mother and father are respected by their children. Those families dwell with the first deities or the first gods or angels, this is another interpretation of it. Where at home the mother and father are respected by their children. Those families dwell with those worthy of gifts. This is like one of the qualities of the enlightened Sangha. Amazing. Where at home the mother and father are respected by their children. And then the Buddha goes on to make it even stronger. He says, he makes his point again. Brahma, monks, is a designation, is a name for mother and father. First teachers is a name for mother and father. First gods or angels, deities, is a name for mother and father. Worthy of gifts is a name for mother and father. And why? This is lovely. This is really touches the heart, I think. Mother and father are very helpful to their children. They raise them, feed them, and show them the world. So that's lovely, really nice. But what I think the Buddha is doing there, he's making it very, very strong. And as I say, the Buddha was very good at the unforgettable images. So thinking of your mum and dad as Brahma, you know, in Buddhist terms or in Asian terms, is really, you know, like God. Would children in the West call their mum and dad God? You know, no way. I don't think so. So, and, you know, the other things that he's talking about too, you know, that first teachers. So these are like the beings that have the influence in our lives, and like gods or angels, they help us. Anyway, I'll talk about that in a minute. So monks, those families dwell with Brahma, where at home the mother and father are respected by their children. As I mentioned, Brahma is the highest, and the qualities of the Brahma beings, these are like heavenly beings, is to have enormous metta, is to have enormous karuna, compassion. Metta is loving kindness, joy with others, mudita and upeka, incredible qualities of this. And any parent will realize that you have to have some deal of these qualities in order to look after children. You have to have loving kindness. You have to have upeka that lets go at the right times gives oneself to another being, looking after another being, while they can't look after themselves. This is the amazing thing, isn't it? For many, many species, the newborn is very quickly independent, or can be independent if necessary. They can still survive. But for a human species, that's not possible for at least, what would be the minimum? Year, two years probably, I think. Minimum. They're absolutely reliant on their parents. So, and of course the Buddha mentions in, what does he mention in the Karaniya Metta Sutta? We just chanted in English. Do you remember that? Yes. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So that's the quality. That's metta, isn't it? That's loving kindness. And that's the ideal quality that we have. Of course, the reality for all of us as parents, I think, know this. It's a bit of a mixed bag. We're not, you know, this high or ideal, but there are aspects of this that come into our relationship with our children. And as I've mentioned to people who are about to become parents, I can see a couple here, this is the having children is part of our practice. It becomes our kamatana, becomes our meditation subject. It becomes the means by which we practice to develop more wholesome states of mind and more positive states of mind and let go of negative states of mind, unwholesome states of mind. That's not easy when your buttons are being pressed, when your conditioning from your life is running, and then you have to encounter, you know, a child who's demanding this, that, and the other, and whatnot. So it's a lot of letting go. It's a lot of developing loving kindness. There's a lot of compassion involved, and also joy for the success of our children when they do something good, when they have some good quality. Just have that joy for it. And also upeka, as I mentioned, this is equanimity, which is letting go, because we let go from wisdom. We just know, yep, got to let go. So, and then the second aspect that the Buddha mentioned, those families dwell with the first teachers where at home the mother and father are respected by their children. Our parents are really the first input we have, actually, in this life. As I mentioned, we come to this life with quite a considerable baggage. Some of it good, some of it not good. That's life. And we learn, you know, just in the basic sense, isn't it? What do we learn from our parents? We learn how to speak. You know, we learn how to speak English. We learn how to speak Sinhala. Very important that children of whatever background learn their mother tongue too. Very important, because the language we speak is a connection to the culture, and gives us a context. They teach us to walk. They teach us to eat, go to the toilet, clean ourselves, and to behave reasonably. So this is quite a lot that we, as parents, you know, are teaching their children. And of course, at the same time, these are the many positive values that we're teaching. That's the main point. Because I think as parents, this is where we can really equip our children, is to give them good values. Where will they get those good values? From example, isn't it? From what we do and say. They will hear the words. We're the same, actually. We hear the words. But if we see our parents doing and saying quite different things, that's the message they will pick up. They're not silly. They're not unintelligent. But one of the most important teachings on the relationship of parents to children and children to parents is the Sigalavada Sutta. Sigalika was a lay person, and the Buddha spoke to him. in the Digha Nikaya, and he was teaching that our relationships are really an interwoven set of duties and responsibilities to each other. They're not rights that we can demand, but like duties, obligations we have to each other, children to parents, parents to children, employers to employees, and so on. He outlined virtually the whole of society. But what he says about parents, parents is very interesting. The five things that he says that parents need to do, and part of this is what they're teaching them too, and we've touched on this. The first thing he says, they will restrain them from doing bad things, evil they have. I don't like this word evil, it's a bit charged, but doing bad things. So in other words, we're pointing out to them the things that are not good to do, particularly coming from bad intention, you know, maybe lying, stealing, taking things, those sorts of things. And we support them, this is what parents do, and everyone hopefully does, in doing good. And most Buddhists will recognize this, isn't it? This is sabbapapasarakaranam kusalasa upasampada. So this is exactly that, that one should restrain or refrain from all unwholesome negative things, and one should enter upon all good things. This is exactly what the Buddha is encouraging us to do for our children. And then the next one is teach them some skill. That's one of our obligations as parents. And some people will interpret this as education, and that's a very important part of it, because in order to get a skill these days, in order to get a job, we need a qualification, so you need quite good education. So in Buddhist countries in particular, you see the emphasis on learning is incredible. It's so strong as compared to, say, the West, where we're a little bit less motivated. And this comes, I would say, from Buddhism, actually. It comes from Buddhism. The emphasis on great learning is very important. Of course, the great learning the Buddha is interested in is Dhamma, because this makes a big difference to our lives. And this is not quite so, doesn't fit quite so well here, because this is what we teach the children, but also to find our children a suitable partner. That was an obligation the Buddha recommended. These days that's not so popular. But I think at least parents should have a bit of a say or an input. And if they're on very good terms with their children, it's quite likely the children will listen to them a bit if they think, no, this boy is not so good for this reason, this girl, do you really think, you know, this could last? And, you know, they can listen. We certainly can't arrange a marriage, which happens in Buddhist countries. But even that is a little bit different when you actually encounter it. Because in Sri Lanka, arranged marriages, organised marriages, are the order of the day. Still predominate, and you see them in the newspapers, advertising, and so on. But the people, they go through a process of seeing if they're compatible and everything. So it's really not what you would think. In fact, I have a totally different take on organised marriage now, is that at least they're looking at each other's good and bad qualities. And, you know, they also look at the assets they have as well. It's like premarital, what do you call it, prenuptial agreements, actually. They've taken it all into account. With romantic love, you dive in at the deep end. You don't know. Maybe you're getting, you know, it is, maybe it's a, what do you say, a marriage or a relationship made in heaven. Maybe it's not, you know. Maybe it's just lust and desire. Who knows? So these organised or arranged marriages are not as negative as you might think. In fact, it's probably a little bit more logical than what we do. If you're going to spend a lifetime with this person, you might as well know what they're all about. So, and the fifth thing that the Buddha recommended for parents, and probably it's good to mention here, is that in due time that we should hand over our inheritance to them, to the children. This is very important to do that. There's a story at the end of it, if we get time. Actually, I probably don't have that much time, but I may go to the story anyway, about handing over inheritance at the right time. So, and let's see how far. All right, I will mention some of this, I think. So, and the Buddha continues, those families dwell with the first gods or angels, deities, where at home mother and father are respected by their children. Because parents, especially as I mentioned, you know, when we are totally helpless, parents are powerful beings. They make things happen. They are like gods, actually. They are. They're our world. If they weren't there for us, we would perish pretty quickly, actually. And they protect us. And their parents are a source of strength, security, and inspiration. And I would say, you know, it's because of this primal aspect of our relationship to our parents that often God, isn't it? God is seen as father, a father figure, or in some cultures a mother figure, because that relationship is so powerful. Without it, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here without, first of all, that we were born to them, that's one thing, but secondly, that they actually supported us so that we could survive, grow up, and have an independent life. So that's, they're like, as I said, they're like the first gods or angels. They're very powerful in our lives. And without them, we wouldn't be here. And those family dwell with those worthy of gifts, where at home the mother and father are respected by the children. As I mentioned, worthy of gifts is a title we use for the enlightened Sangha. We talk about the enlightened Sangha in the Itipissa, which we chanted. And so it's very, very strong. It's also interesting, it's probably hard for people in the West, those watching YouTube, to realise that in Buddhist countries, children actually bow to their parents. They'll bow to their parents. Sometimes when they go to school in the morning and sometimes before they go to bed, it depends on the parents. But they do bow. And it's very nice to see, actually, that act of bowing is a sign of respect. Of course, as I mentioned, it's most important where the mind is. If you're bowing with disrespect in the mind, you know, not so good. But it's a good thing anyway to be doing this. So it's a very different relationship to parents than we experience in the West. And the Buddha, as I mentioned, he's in this Sigala or Vada Sutta, he's talking about interlocking qualities of duties and responsibilities, obligations. So a child's obligation to their parents is very important. And this is the Buddha's words. Having been supported by them, parents, I will support them. And I'd say, especially when they're sick or old. And the second thing the Buddha said, I will perform their duties for them. And I'd qualify that, especially when sick or old, but any time, really. Third thing the Buddha said, I will keep up the family tradition. And this is continue the good works of the parents or any traditions that they have that are worthy of keeping going. There's probably some that aren't. And the fourth thing the Buddha says, I will be worthy of my heritage, my inheritance. And so we should act in ways, children should act in ways worthy, to be worthy of that. And to preserve, you know, this is very strong in Buddhist countries, the ancestral property. This is what it's got here. That's a very strong thing. The family home in Buddhist countries is really a strong thing. And when people sell a family home in Sri Lanka, it's not that easy, actually. It's a big tug, I think. That's my idea, anyway. And the fifth thing the Buddha says that children should, their obligation, their duty to their parents is, after my parents' death, this is the Buddha's words, I will distribute gifts on their behalf. And this is like making merit, making good karma in memory of them. So very important. So now I'd like to just finish with a nice story. It's quite an inspiring story from the Dhammapada. So it's a lovely story that it also points out to you, you might think, hearing all this, that Buddhists have this incredible respect for their parents. It's extraordinary and they're always like this. This story gives you a little bit more balance, coming from probably roughly the time, well, coming from the time of the Buddha, actually. It's from the Dhammapada commentary. This is a famous collection of verses by the Buddha. And this story is about Bahuputtika. Do you know Bahuputtika? Some of the Buddhists will know. The name means, this is a name given to a woman, many children. Bahu means many, and Puttika usually means sons, I would think, but children in general. So it shows that not all were, all children were respectful at the time of the Buddha. You'll hear this. In the town that the Buddha spent most of his life in, Sarvati, there was a couple with many children who grew up and they got married. And when later, when they were married and they had children, the father died. And the children asked their mother for the inheritance. And they said to her, this is probably heard, still said today, we'll look after you if you give us the property. If you give us our inheritance, we will look after you. And we'll take care of you. No worry, Mum. She had many children, so she probably thought that was okay. So she eventually she gave all her property and she didn't keep anything for herself. And then she started going through the children. She went to the eldest son and she stayed with him. And it sounds like tensions immediately. And daughter-in-law said to, and I don't know if she said it to the mother, but she said, and probably said it to her husband, she has come to stay with us as if she has given us two shares of the inheritance. The mother heard this and she decided she would leave. So she went to the next child, same story. She went to the next child, same story. None of them wanted to support her for long. None of them paid her any due respect. They didn't give her respect at all. And, you know, reading between the lines, and you probably read between the lines too, not only were the children at fault, one might think, but I wondered about the mother, because maybe she was a difficult customer to deal with, you know, very unpleasant. And so hence the hot potato treatment, we call it. Hot potato is when you quickly pass it over it. And so this mother, now destitute as it were, decided to become a bhikkhuni, a Buddhist nun. She became a Buddhist nun. Hopefully not just because she was destitute. That would be a pretty, pretty poor reason, but nevertheless, it happens. And she applied herself very diligently. She put a lot into her practice. And one night, she'd meditate the whole night on Dhamma. She'd practice very, very strongly. And then one night, they say the Buddha like sent an emanation. They call it a radiance, but I think emanation is better. And a saying which she could meditate on. And that saying is the Dhammapada verse. And the Dhammapada verse is, better it is to live one day seeing the Supreme Truth than to live 100 years without ever seeing the Supreme Truth. Better it is to live one day seeing the Supreme Truth than to live 100 years without ever seeing the Supreme Truth. And reflecting on this, she became an arahant, fully enlightened as a result of that. So I'd just like to conclude there that, you know, we investigate the nature, investigate firstly the issue of respect and see if it is something that's lacking in our lives, if it is something that's worthwhile, and how we can develop it. And to look at, are we respectful to our parents? Are we appreciative to our parents? That's another talk, actually, whether we're appreciative or grateful to our parents. But it's worth, focusing on this, you know, and to realise in Buddhist countries, of course, the idea about debt, what we owe our parents, is very strong, very strong. So I'd like to leave it there because there may be some questions, you know, just the last few minutes, just some questions that people will have from the internet or from the floor. Maybe comments, questions or complaints. No. I really wanted to actually play some music too, which is really, I would really like to have played it, which is in Sri Lanka, this is very famous, very moving Kavi Bana. It is actually Kavi Bana, and it's called Amma. And it's mother, and it's really haunting. And even though I understand only some of the similar, it really goes to the heart. It's really all the qualities of a mother. I mean, you know, in the West, would we have a very popular sort of song, we might call it, like that? One about mother? It's amazing. They have one about father, but it's not as good. Mother's better, I thought. It's more haunting and very atmospheric, you know. Yeah. It sounds like mother has passed away in this sort of Kavibana. Kavibana means like a poem, but it's a Dhamma poem, as it were. And there's quite a bit of that in Sri Lanka.
Mm. Okay. What I'd like to say is, you were talking about how when the Buddhists here bow before you, they're not bowing before you as a person. Yep. They're bowing to the Dharma. In the same way, I'm thinking about the notion of a parent. Mm. It sounds to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that that's an ideal. That's an idea, if you like. Mm. And working with parents, I'd have to say that many of them have grown up in very, very difficult circumstances. Mm-hmm. And we tend to, as you say, treat our parents like gods, and we tend to repeat what they do.
That's a very good point.
There's a lot of learning in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it is a journey, isn't it, of becoming this ideal, or meeting this ideal of a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And I doubt whether many of us have actually succeeded fully along the way. And maybe the same can be said for a Buddhist teacher, I don't know.
No, I don't think so. Especially when you see some of the news about some Buddhist teachers.
Yeah, so that was my thought. This is much more complicated than just respecting a parent.
Yeah.
If you've got a parent who sexually abuses one of your kids or yourself, then, you know, it does affect how you feel about that person.
Yeah.
So I think it's very complicated.
Yeah.
Just wanted to add that.
No, I agree. Because the nitty-gritty, it is an ideal, isn't it? It's very much an ideal. And thank you for pointing that out. Because the reality on the ground is quite different in a way. Because we all come to this life with a lot of conditioning, you know, from our previous life. We get a lot of conditioning from this life. And that is what's running when we interact with each other. Sometimes we will take it personally. We think this person is a bad person, or he's a bad person, she's a bad person. But really, in essence, what we're dealing with is somebody with unfortunate or negative conditioning, and hence this abuse that's coming out. And if you react to it like that, if you take it like that, it's a lot less personal. It still hurts, but it's a lot less personal. You can work with it. You realize this person, you know, who may be an abuser, that's not the sum total of their being. Maybe they can change, they can recondition. And I think, you know, you're right. You know, there's a lot of things in family life, particularly in the West, you know, where there are many difficult situations, which maybe in a Buddhist culture, I'm not quite sure, don't come into play as much. They do, you know, because you hear of alcohol's a big problem in Sri Lanka in relationships, and I'm sure parents are very similar. They have negative qualities just the same as here in the West. So it is an ideal, but it's a different place to come from, you know, in terms of looking at our parents. You know, as I say, now, you know, often for people, parents are seen as the villains. You know, is that fair? I mean, they really have done such a marvellous job. They've given up such a lot. And I know one monk, Ajahn Jayasari, he says this, you know, even if our parents were cold and callous, at least, at the very least, they gave us one thing which is so important, life. They gave us this opportunity. But you're right, it is an ideal. But it's an important... A reorientation of the mind. This is why right view is so important, because that's the way that the Buddha is encouraging us to look at the world, investigate if it's true, because of course, you know, you can believe right view and think, yeah, that's okay. But in the end, we have to know it for ourselves. Buddha is unpacking it, for sure. But if we come to our relations, family relationships, with a sense of respect for parents, it's a different place from where we're coming in the West now. Most children don't have that respect. And they lose out because of that, actually, because respect is such a beautiful quality to have for our own benefit. Often we see it as something we're giving somebody else, but it's not. We it's our own gift, as it were, to ourselves. Yes. Yeah, that's true. And that's what you pointed out, actually, when you mentioned, you know, the pattern of abuse that can be continued. It's very sad for me that somebody that having been abused will then become an abuser. I remember, you know, my childhood, you know, you always encountered negative situations and so on, bullying and whatnot. I experienced this as a child. I never, never wanted to do that to anybody else. But according to psychology, 90% of people do. And they just reenact, you know, the sexual abuse, the physical abuse, the emotional abuse, the verbal abuse that they suffered. And the only thing I can think of, you probably come up, psychologists probably know the deep reason for this, is that, you know, they want to get back, they want revenge, but on your own children? this is terrible. So, but...
It's like you're copying your parents being
mum
and dad.
Yeah, true. True roles, we're copying. Yeah, that's very true, actually. But hopefully, as adults, and you know, in terms of Buddhism, we're encouraged to look at, you know, things that we've taken on. Are they wholesome? Unwholesome? Are they leading to our happiness or unhappiness? You know, and just use our intelligence. So, as you say, you know, often the children of alcoholics can become alcoholics, and sexual abusers can become sexual abusers in their later life. Children who have been abused sexually become. So these things, you know, it's part of seeing cause and effect. It's a very deep aspect of it. But the good news, we can do something about it. We can recondition. So I don't know if there are any other questions from the internet, or we can just finish off fairly soon, actually. Yes. But thank you for that. That's very important, actually. It's very important. Right.
Ajahn, thank you very much for the anusasana.
Yeah.
Parents know it's nearly impossible to get it right all the time.
Yeah.
Now, it's also true that just like everything else in life, parenthood is an opportunity to practice the Dhamma.
Absolutely.
It's also true sometimes if we are not aware of the limits, one can push oneself to the extremes, to the point of self-neglect, trying to, you know, maybe accumulate wealth and so many other things, looking after one's family. So it can be difficult sometimes to determine what is enough, especially, you know, to a point where you leave enough time for oneself, self-reflection and practice of Dhamma and meditation. I know there's no straight answer, but I'd appreciate if you could, you know, advise.
Yes, it is a balancing act, actually, for all of us. You know, I think particularly, you know, work commitments, family commitments, and commitments to our own welfare and development as well. You know, as you said, time on our own and so forth, having time for ourselves. But an important part of it is to see the whole of life as part of the practice. We live life as different compartments, don't we? Work compartment, say school compartment, family compartment, and temple compartment when you come here, whatever compartments, all these compartments. But really all of them are opportunities to practice Dhamma and to develop the wholesome, reduce the unwholesome. It sounds so simple. I know it isn't. It is simple to say, but hard to do. And this includes work and home, everything. In actual fact, someone said to me the other day, we probably spend more time at work than at home. The time we spend at home is a lot of it sleeping, you know. And that's quite true, you know. She pointed that out to me. And I said, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's true. So all these different compartments are opportunities. They're actually our practice, our meditation subject. Sometimes people think of their meditation subject as loving kindness, as anapanasati, the breath meditation, and so on. But really, our lives, our response to life is our practice. Because if we're responding positively, with wholesome states, fantastic, this is the direction to go in, to develop more of, we're doing the right thing. If we're finding unwholesome states coming up, negative states coming up, then this is a direction we know will lead to our unhappiness, and then we start to think, we've got to do it differently. So really, the big thing for us as practitioners is to see the whole of life as our practice, to see that the mind is the mind, the heart. This is our area of practice. Where do we have it? 24/7. So every compartment is actually part of our practice. And this is very, very important, you know. It is important to have formal practice time because that allows us to get peaceful, to recondition the mind in a much deeper way, and to be able to take that into our daily life wherever. So we have to, you know, be able to listen to ourselves too, and pay attention to the inner voice that says, "This is too much. You know, I've got to pull up," because we have a sense of that. And as you say, it can go, you know, overboard and then feel a bit strained or, a bit strained by what we've done, you know. So it's a balancing practice. So. But always to see where the mind's coming from, that's the important thing. And that will bring us happiness. So. All right, yes, one. This is the last. I don't think there's any from the internet. Two from the internet. All right, very quick then, yes. Just quick, because 11 o'clock we have the very important thing, lunch.
So thanks so much for the talk, Ajahn.
That's fine, comrade.
Very relevant to us,
yes,
just Magda and I, and thanks for the support
thank you.
The last few weeks,
yeah.
Sort of for us leading up to our parenting journey. But I had a question about psychotherapy.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wondering what your thoughts were about the usefulness of psychotherapy and how it often looks at parenting in regards to a person's sort of challenges at the moment, or you know, at the present
time.
Yeah.
You mean in a negative sort of sense, you know, like blaming the parents or seeing problems coming from the parents, or
because
usually in a therapy setting that's what you're looking at, isn't it? You don't go there and say, wow, it's wonderful, my parents, you know, or these good qualities I have and they're due to my parents. That doesn't happen. So I think psychotherapy, yes, I think it has its value, you know, it has its value, but sometimes the premises, the view is not, you know, in accord with, I'd say, with reality, with what the Buddha, an enlightened being, saw. And so therefore there can be a lot of psychotherapy can be based on self a lot, a sense of self, and this is not necessarily a useful thing or a true thing. And also it may not take into account that we've had many rebirths before, many lives, you know, may not even take that on as a possibility. So coming from a different place. So, you know, psychotherapy, I think, has its value. And, of course, people will see if it works for them. They develop more positive states of mind. They can accept things more easily. But also, you know, we have to look for ourselves and investigate the roots, the real roots for our situation. So I think it has a benefit for sure. People, otherwise, it wouldn't keep going. And if it were just blaming somebody else, parents or whatever, that wouldn't be of much use anyway, because that's just a negative and... you know, it's not something that can nourish us.
Can I add something to that? As a psychotherapist, you really need to come from a detached point of view, without judgment.
Yeah, no, you do. Yeah, you do.
If it doesn't happen, then I don't think you should do that for someone else.
Yeah, that's very true. So now the last two questions, and then we can just quickly move on.
Okay, so this is from the US, and you may have answered part of this earlier on the first question,
good.
But I'm confused.
Yeah, I'm confused.
Sorry, but if a child is born to a physically / sexually abusive parents,
yes.
Are we to believe that the child was attracted to that?
Yes, yes. I know. That's why I mentioned that. I hope you sort of got a bit of that from what I said before, that this wanting and desire is a wanting and desire to be reborn. And it's driven by an attraction. Sometimes the attraction is positive, in a sense that the parents may be very good parents. Sometimes the attraction is strong, but then they are very negative influence on our lives. So I think the thing we desire is this, in Buddhism we call it bhava tanha. This desire to exist is so strong. And the attraction, there is a strong attraction, but we don't know whether the attraction is positive or negative. Just as in relationships, you can see this, you know, people are attracted to other people very, very strongly, and it can turn out to be the disaster of their lives. The attraction is really strong, but the chemistry, the way they relate is so negative. So it's just the same for rebirth. We just don't know what we're getting into when we want to be reborn. That's the bottom line. And the attraction, there's a strong energy to be attracted to these people, and we don't realise what the real nature of that attraction is until we're reborn, until we're in that relationship, as it were. So that's one. So I hope that helps answer that, has some... addresses that somewhat for the person in the USA. So, yes, definitely. Yeah.
So the second one is also from the US.
Yeah, good.
Why is there an assumption that a mother would universally protect her child with their life in the Metta Sutta? Mm-hmm. What is the nature of that love? And just continuing with that question, is it still attachment or is it unconditional compassion?
Right, right. Yes, it is an ideal, but... You know, I can say from my own experience, seeing mothers, I'm not a mother, or not a father even, I've seen that. It's amazing the quality of letting go that parents have, the devotion I see that mothers have to their children. You know, it's and they're quite rightly pointing out there is a lot of attachment with that. You know, a mother's love for a child. They're attached to their child, but not the child next door. So the child next door can be crying or whatever. They may be concerned, they may not, but it won't be the same as if their child is crying. They will hear that and really respond. So you're right, it's with attachment. But of course, the Buddha is pointing to that quality of selfless love, selfless giving. Another word for love is giving, in a sense. Is the image of a mother's love for a child, but it's without that sense of attachment. Because that is love with attachment, you know. Love with attachment is many conditions apply. So it's not, you know, you could say that most mothers' love for their children isn't selfless, universal. It is with attachment and it is specific. But the Buddha is actually pointing to that quality and meaning it as like something more universal, you know. So that one, you can use this actually as a meditation subject, and I use it sometimes, thinking of oneself as one's own child, like the mother who loves the child. And then you can think, and you use that to generate that sense of loving kindness or friendliness, you know, that care, that real warmth care, that one's own baby. It sounds strange, doesn't it? And then you can start thinking of other beings, whether they be family, friends, as like your children, and then acquaintances as your children, and then even those that you don't get on with as your children, naughty children, and then all beings as our children, that relationship. You can use that energy, that energetic energy of love, and broaden it so that it has no boundaries. It's not just my child, it's all children. So it can be a very powerful way to generate metta, loving kindness, or friendliness is another word for it. So yes, right. Thank you very much for that. US, that's a person who is in USA. That's very true. So this is good. It's obviously being confronting, and you know, it confronts what a lot of our cultural assumptions in the West, because when they hear this, when we hear this, this what the Buddha is encouraging us to develop this respect, it goes against the grain for us. But we have to ask, why is that? That's what the bottom line is. So thank you very much for coming this morning, listening, and for the feedback. It's always a good sign. You weren't asleep, that's what I think. So very good. So now those who would like to, we can pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha.